We have four argued cases this morning. The first is number 21-1888, Centripetal Networks, Inc. v. Cisco Systems, Inc. Mr. Fleming.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Mark Fleming, together with Sophie Brooks, on behalf of Cisco. I would address 3 points.
Before you start, let me clarify what's involved here. In the district court, you argued that recusal was required under 455A, and the briefing here addresses only 455B4. Can we assume that you're waiving any argument under 455A?
You can assume that, Judge Dyke. I mean, we certainly pressed 455A, as this court always advises. We had to pick our issues on appeal. We had to brief a number of merits issues as well. So we picked the 455B, which we think is a clear violation. We do also think there was a 455A problem, but we are not presenting that to the court today.
Well, you're not presenting it to court today, so you're waiving that, are you?
That's fair, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, all right.
We're proceeding under 455B. And our position is there was a violation of 455B starting on August 11, 2020, when the district judge discovered the financial interest. Second, that the proper remedy is vacator of all orders and judgments entered after that date, as this court did in the Shell case. And then third, also as in Shell, the case should be remanded to a different district judge who can decide what further proceedings are appropriate. And unless
the court... If I understand your brief on appeal, and correct me if I'm mistaken about this, that the only rulings that the judge made that you're challenging on appeal were rulings that he made after he discovered the stock ownership, right?
That's correct. The findings of fact and conclusions of law that were issued in October, then subsequently the entry of judgment and the decision of our post-judgment motions under Rule 52 and Rule 59. And all of those we submit need to be vacated and set aside and the case sent back to a new district judge.
And just to pursue this point one further step, I don't remember, did any of your arguments, particularly on the post-trial, renew arguments that you had lost in pre-judgment rulings?
As I stand here, I don't think there were any further... I mean, I think we probably did preserve our positions, for instance, on claim construction in post-trial filings, in our proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law,
but
for instance.
I don't remember if you... Don't you do or you do not have claim construction arguments in your blue brief?
No, we did not appeal any claims.
Okay.
That's correct.
Well, you have claim construction arguments, but it's because the claim construction was changed as part of the final decision from the Markman construction.
For one of them, that's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. So if I may proceed with 455B, and of course I'm happy to take questions on any of these subjects. I think the court has our briefing and has our positions. I don't think it's disputed that ownership of the Cisco stock is a financial interest for purposes of 455B. And the only dispute, I think, among the parties as to whether there was a violation is whether moving the Cisco stock and only the Cisco stock into a blind trust constitutes divesting himself or herself of the interest for purposes of 455F. We think the plain language of the statute answers that. To divest means to deprive or dispossess of the financial interest. 455D4 defines financial interest as ownership of a legal or equitable interest, however small. So when 455F speaks of divesting of the interest, it requires giving up ownership, and a blind trust doesn't do that. All of the authorities that have carefully considered this have concluded putting assets into a blind trust does not remove them from the ethics rules, and we think the views of the Judicial Conference's Committee on Codes of Conduct is particularly persuasive here, as the committee says.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but in terms of the orders between October 21st, 2019 and August 11, 2020, do you believe those do not need to be vacated?
They don't need to be vacated. Of course, when one goes back to the district judge always has authority to reconsider interlocutory orders to the extent they need to be reconsidered. A new district judge would have that same authority. But I don't think this court needs to vacate them because our position is, at least given the record as we know it, we're not arguing there was a 455B violation during that time. But all those orders would be open to...
I'm sorry.
No, please.
I said I'm not sure that your statement about the authority to vacate the rulings is correct. This is the further proceedings would be governed by Rule 63. excuse me, my understanding of the interpretation that's been given to Rule 63 is that the new judge can't vacate the old rulings. But, I mean, that's not something that's for us to decide now, I guess. But
no, I agree with that. I mean, I direct the court to this court's decision in Exxon versus United States, which is 931 Fed Second 874, where this court has said a successor judge steps into the shoes of his or her predecessor, is bound by the same rulings, but to the extent a trial judge can alter a previous ruling, so too can a successor judge. And that doesn't change when you've got a Rule 63 process where you have a new judge who comes in. Certainly, obviously, the new judge will look at the reasoning behind the former rulings. It might take them as persuasive, but I don't think there's anything in Rule 63 that forbids a new judge from reconsidering an interlocutory order just the same way as Judge Morgan would have been able to if he were still sitting on the case.
It might be a little bit stronger than that. There might actually be a law of the case hurdle to overcome.
I don't know that law of the case applies when you're talking about an interlocutory order and the case hasn't gone to judgment. I mean, unless this court were to say something, which my understanding is this court is not going to address the merits unless it decides not to vacate, which we, of course, think it should. But I don't think an interlocutory ruling by a district judge, whether the same district judge or a prior district judge, is law of the case. I don't know if authority is saying that. But this is something, again, that the new district judge could consider after hearing from the parties. Well, I'm happy to talk further about divestment. I think that the court has our views, and most importantly, I think the views of the judicial conference, which is that using a blind trust is not a divestment. It doesn't alter the ethics rules. We brought this, the opinion, advisory opinion 110, to the district court's attention. The court didn't address it. We also have the House report that accompanied the amendment to 455 in 1974, which says that 455C, quote, precludes use of a so-called blind trust. Judge McEwen's article makes the same point. We also have the executive branch's approach, which I think is also persuasive here. The Office of Government Ethics has a promulgated regulation on this, which interprets 18 U.S.C. 208, in which Congress used the same phrase, financial interest, as is used in 455. And the regulation says, in the case of a blind trust, conflict of interest statutes apply to the assets that an interested party transfers to the trust until he or she is notified by the trustee that the asset has been disposed of or has a value of less than $1,000. And the regulation explains why that is, because the interested party knows what assets he or she has placed into the trust. And there's no requirement that the assets be diversified in any way, so there's still the possibility that the interested party could be influenced by the investment. That's particularly the case in a situation like this, where the only assets transferred into the blind trust were the party's stock. Centripetal, on the other side, only cites a 2005 Law Review article. It says without elaboration that a judge can move assets into a blind trust, doesn't cite anything, doesn't engage with the plain language of the statute or the House report. It predated Advisory Opinion 110 by about 8 years. So we don't think that the authors of that article would stand by their statement even today. And even if they would, it's not a sufficient basis, we think, for this court to go against the terms of the statute and the very well-considered views of the Judicial Conference.
We don't have any reason to think that Judge Morgan has, or Judge Morgan's wife has, divested this stock since the papers here were filed?
No, no indication was given. And I'll note that the trust document, which Judge Morgan gave to the parties, which neither party cited, so they're not in the appendix, but we can provide them if the court wants to see them, specifically envisioned that the trustee would inform Mrs. Morgan if the assets were to be transferred or go below $1,000 in value. And we've been given no indication that such a notification was given.
And I take it your view would be that even if that happened, that wouldn't cure the problem.
No, I was just using that simply.
And it would be too late anyway.
Correct, absolutely. Okay. Chase Manhattan makes clear that a divestment many years after the key decisions have been made is not enough to trigger the 455F safe harbor. So unless the court has further questions about divestment, I mean, we've talked a bit about the remedy. I think the closest analogy here is this court's decision in Shell. It was a 455B case like this one. It involved just under 100 shares of stock. Their stock had been inherited rather than purchased. Unlike here, the judge only learned of the stock after entering detailed merits decisions on summary judgment. Also unlike here, he took the initiative and tried to address the problem by severing off the companies that were implicated by the financial interest and only entering judgment as to the other companies. This court still vacated. And here I think it's an even more compelling case. Unlike in Shell, the judge at first proposed to do nothing at all, simply told the parties about it. The court's comments at the hearing suggested that the court did not view 455B as the bright line that this court has said that it is. So we think this is a case where the same remedy as in Shell is appropriate.
Can I ask you, is there a case that involved an exercise of appellate discretion as to a remedy to deny a remedy for a B4 violation? Shell didn't, although it spoke of the possibility or spoke of remedial discretion. I guess on the basis of Liljeburg, which was only a 455A case anyway. But are there cases that actually say, even with a violation of this bright line rule and a decision entered while that violation was going on, we're going to say we're not going to undo that?
I think, and I don't know that it was framed in terms of discretion, but I think this court's decision in Polaroid may be an example of that, where there was an analysis that because it wasn't clear that there even was a violation, even assuming that there had been one, the party that was raising the violation, their Kodak, had waited 6 years in order to do it. What happened there was the judge disclosed that her mother-in-law had stock in Kodak, and said, I don't think I need to recuse because of my mother-in-law
old stock. At the time of the earlier judgments?
Yes, but far before, and then the case went to trial, it went up to appeal, cert was denied on liability, it came back for trial on damages, and by that point, the mother-in-law had passed away, and the judge said, I'm now a beneficiary of the will, so I'm going to recuse myself from further proceedings. And Kodak said, we want to undo everything that's gone before. And this court said, no, that's not appropriate. Even if the judge maybe should have recused 6 years before, which is something the court assumed and did not decide, nonetheless it found, I think under the rubric of harmless error, essentially, that because Kodak had waited so long that it would harm the reputation of the courts to undo something that the party had sat idly by and endured without objection. I think that's the only example I can come up with and the only example that's
attributable. But there are some other examples. I mean, I think there's a circuit case that refused in a B4 situation to vacate where the only rulings being challenged were legal rulings that would be reviewed de novo on appeal. I know we rejected that in the Shell case, but I think there's other circuit authority, but that's not the case here. We're not dealing with it.
Oh, by no means. No, in fact, Centripetal throughout its brief on the merits is very clear. It seeks highly deferential review by this court of the factual findings. We, of course, have some arguments that we've made as a matter of law on the merits, but as Your Honor noted, that doesn't make a difference under the decision in Shell. So we think under both Shell and under the Liljeburg factors, I mean, this really is a situation where I think not vacating would send a very dangerous message, and it would suggest that investments could be disregarded or simply not found out, that one could go through and issue what is, a historic judgment and then simply move the stock into a blind trust. And I don't know that that's the message that this court wanted to send, and certainly not in Shell, and there's no reason to treat this case differently from Shell. Unless the court has other questions at this time, I've reserved the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Well, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Andre?
May it please the court. There's been no allegations in this case that the district court judge was biased based on his wife's stock purchase of Cisco stock. And that's an important fact to consider.
But he was still obligated to recuse, right?
He was when he found out.
At least once he became aware of the stock market.
That's correct. But the bias issues will be very important when we look at what the remedy is for vacator. What Cisco is complaining about is that the judge misinterpreted the statute, particularly 455F, regarding whether or not the divestment or the divested himself of the interest was sufficiently done by a blind trust. Now, there's never been a single case which that term has been interpreted by any court. So when this court makes a determination, it'll be the first time it's ever been construed, that statute. So it will be a case of first impression. There's also no clear congressional intent what that means, divest of his or her interest in the disqualifying financial stake. The judge in this case went above and beyond to try to do the right thing. He actually paid money out of his own pocket to hire a lawyer to devise this blind trust. That was a form of divestment. The term divest is a general term.
Do you have any case law to support what you're arguing right now?
No, there's no case law on this at all. Either way, one way or the other. The only thing that both parties have are some secondary sources. They are not meant to be used for interpretive processes. Like,
well, the In Re Cement litigation case, whatever the name of it is, does have a statement in there that land trust doesn't work, right?
Exactly. For 455C, and if you look at the congressional record back from 1974, it actually talks about you should not put your investments into a blind trust. Judges should not put their investment into blind trust. But then they single out, they differentiate the judges' spouses and minor children living at home as a different class of investments. He should be reasonably, make himself reasonably aware of their financial interests. There is just not a clear-cut definition as to what the divestment should have been in this case. But Judge Morgan's interpretation of that was reasonable. He was trying to avoid a situation that it would be counterproductive to what the spirit of the law was about.
Can you cite a definition of divest that supports your position?
I Googled it yesterday, divest. I pulled it off Google. Deprive someone of power, rights, or possession. Now, Judge Morgan's wife, when she put into blind trust, she relinquished control, responsibility, and knowledge of that. She no longer has the rights to control that issue. So it's a general interpretation. If this court gives a very strict interpretation, a bright line test of what divest means, it'll be for the first time. But Judge Morgan went with a more general, flexible approach to determine what divest is. He did it because the spirit of 455F, which was created 14 years after 455A, B, and C in 74, came out. That 14-year gap created a lot of problems. Your Honor mentioned In Re Cement. The Ninth Circuit case that calls it this ridiculous issue come up where a judge's wife had invested in a handful of stocks in a very large class action. So they brought in 450, the Congress brought in 455F for this very solution, to give the judges some flexibility when they've invested substantial time in the matter to divest the interest. And that's what Judge Morgan attempted to do. Now, there's absolutely no proof of bias. That's the reason Cisco dropped the 455A argument. The original observer standard would not have flown here. So we're looking at just a simple interpretation of the statute. If Judge Morgan interpreted the statute incorrectly, like I said, it's never been done before, it was not egregious, it was not clear-cut. And that's what's required for vacature. You have to have an egregious example. And vacature should only be, as the Supreme Court says in Liljeburg, in extraordinary circumstances. And one of the things we did in our brief is we focused on the three Liljeburg factors. The risk of the injury to the parties in the particular case, the risk of denial of the relief will produce injustice in other cases, and the risk of undermining the public confidence in the judicial process. All three of those factors weigh very heavily for no vacature.
This is a harmless error argument?
It is to some degree, but it's the harmless error, and on those three factors, they all weigh in favor of no vacature. If you look at the very first factor, the risk of injustice to the parties in this particular case, is there a risk of injustice to Cisco if there is no vacature? Well, we've already established that no one's alleging bias. There's no bias here at all. So there's no injustice to Cisco if there's no vacature. On the other hand, if there is vacature, there's extreme injustice.
Just on the bias point, I guess my understanding has been that maybe the central reason for this small set of bright line rules is that an inquiry into bias is a potentially very unreliable and difficult and uncertain inquiry. And so in a defined set of circumstances, Congress has decided that we are just not going to make that inquiry at all. In these circumstances, which are clear enough, we're just going to say the public perception as a categorical matter is sufficiently at risk because of the possibility of bias, and we're just not going to go beyond that. Why is that not a kind of a driving concern for, let's call it, the remedial issue here?
Because under the Supreme Court factors, under Liljeburg, the three factors.
And that was, again, that was a 455A case, right?
It was a 455A, but it's also been applied to 455B in other cases.
Well, I'm not aware of any case that has said we're going to inquire whether there was actual bias in a B4 situation before we find that there was an obligation to recuse or in determining whether the remedy should be vacatur.
No, I think Your Honor is correct. There is no case that you made that determination. But here I'm saying there's not an allegation of bias. Cisco has not even had an allegation of bias. So that's a big difference. The judge said he had already formed his opinion, had already written his draft of the opinion by the time he found out about the stock.
Well, most of it.
Well, yeah. He said about 150 pages. It turned out to be 167 pages, something like that. But he had already made up his mind. He said the stock purchase could not and did not inform his decision. So the fact that there's no challenge or no allegation of bias is what I'm talking about in this particular instance. It's already admitted there is no bias.
This notion that the judge had already made his decision by the time he discovered the stock ownership seems to me somewhat inconsistent with the history of this statute, which arose in significant part out of the Haynesworth confirmation hearings, where there was a question as to whether he should have recused in a circuit case because of stock ownership that he discovered after the oral argument and I guess after the straw vote. And he was criticized for that at the confirmation hearing, and that experience was what led to this automatic recusal provision in the statute. So that would seem to suggest that the fact that the judge is fairly far down the road in making a decision isn't the ground for permitting him to continue.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the reason 455 was enacted. And I'll quote, and I give the congressional record. It says, the section proposed to amend 28 U.S.C. 455 to modify the automatic disqualification provision to permit a judge or his or her spouse of minor children to resolve the conflict by divesting themselves of the property creating the conflict. So 455F was actually designed to solve the automatic disqualification. So it's not that bright line test. But even if it is, if the court finds that he did not divest properly, and then you look at the remedy, and there's two different things. The recusal is one issue. Vacator is a completely separate issue and a different inquiry. And the Supreme Court has laid out the inquiry of that, and the public confidence is one of those issues. But the first two issues involve whether or not there be injustice to the parties or a risk of injustice to other cases. Now, if this court gets to the vacator issue, there's obviously no risk of injustice to Cisco with no vacature, but there's a huge risk to Centripetal.
I'm sorry, why is there obviously no risk of injustice to Cisco?
Because as Cisco has not alleged any bias because of the judge's wife's stock ownership. She actually bought stock in Cisco. So if anything...
Right, but I mean, I've always had difficulty understanding why the direction of the ruling and the ownership could in any reliable way indicate that there's really no risk to the party whose stock was owned, because a perfectly plausible reaction of a judge under the obligation to be impartial upon discovering ownership is to bend over backwards against his wife's own financial interest. And as long as that's a plausible concern, which psychologically it surely is, how do you erase that as a possibility?
Well, as the record indicates here, the judge said he had already made his decision and drafted his opinion. He had editing to do, and he put down his pen when he found out about the stock. He stopped working on it until after.
Have you ever changed your drafts in the late editing process to do something other than, find typos to actually change a result? I have.
I think it's plausible you could change your draft, but the judge said it did not and could not. That's the record. It did not and could not change his opinion. He'd already formed his opinion. So I would take the judge at his word. So the risk of injustice here would be much more outweighed. Just like the Polaroid case,
Well, you get back to the Haynesworth situation, which led to the statute, which was exactly a situation in which the argument was, well, he was so far down the line that it wouldn't have had any effect. And that was thought to be inadequate as a justification for continuing.
Well, under the vacatur standards and the way that the Supreme Court has set up the factors, that is one of the factors you look at. You look at factor three, which is the public interest in having a neutral and impartial judiciary. That is.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel's list of what would be vacated if we find a violation of 455b4?
I think if this court decides to vacate, they can send it back to the district court, but there's no not necessary to reassign the case to a new judge. That is an extreme measure to take.
What case has given it back to the same judge who should have recused himself?
Well, if this court determines that the judge did not divest properly, you can tell him how to divest properly, and he can divest that interest properly, and then have the opinion back in front of him. So it is something that's the only issue that's really at stake here. Did the judge divest his interest properly?
Just to be clear, I'm not sure I heard an answer to Judge Cunningham's question. I think Mr. Fleming said all orders from August 11th going forward have to be vacated.
I disagree with that.
You disagree?
Yes. I think
I'm assuming that something needs to be vacated. What's the subset that you would say can stay in place?
I'd say the merits memorandum opinion, original opinion that he had already drafted, stays in place, and then the subsequent post trial would be what would be vacated, because he had already formed the one opinion. It was done. It was completed, and that's the logical breaking point. But once again, I do want to go back to vacator, because I do think that's an extreme, extraordinary remedy. And I don't think that's what the Supreme Court had in mind in those Lugerberg factors.
And do you have a case in which a court of appeals has remanded to a judge that violated, as it turns out, a B4 or any of the B rules and said, since you can divest, we're going to remand it to you because you can keep the case if you do divest?
No, because as I said, this would be a case of first impression. This issue has never come up about what is a proper divestiture or not, whether a blind trust is a proper divestiture. There's not a case on point. So what I'm saying is there's no time limit on divestiture. It's not strict. It has to be a certain amount of time.
Does the word prompt, is that in the statute?
No, it's not in the statute.
Oh, okay.
So it is something that... It just talks about divest himself or herself of the interest provided the grounds for disqualification. But
do you know why the judge treated that other stock differently? I think it was called Cloud Gear or something like that. Do you have any more insight on that?
It was a former partner of Centripetal, and so he just sold it because it had no difference. It was not one of the parties. The interest here, the problem the judge had here was, with owning Cisco stock, he wanted to go by the letter of the law. And these facts in this case, the judge did everything possible to make sure the public had confidence in what was going on.
They didn't divest. Huh? I mean, assuming that putting it in a blind trust is not divestiture.
Well,
he didn't divest. I mean, the statute told him exactly what to do, and he didn't do it.
Well, if you look at a very strict interpretation of divestiture, then that would be correct. But he did... do what he thought was right by the spirit of the law. And so this is one of those public interest issues that a vacatur would have much more harm on how the judiciary is perceived than a non-vacatur. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Fleming, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. 4 points, if I may. First of all, the statute doesn't say divest of control. It says divest of the interest, and it defines what the interest is. It means ownership. So merely giving up whatever control was given up by putting it into a blind trust does not satisfy the plain language of the statute. There is no need to show an egregious violation, actual bias. That wasn't shown in Shell. It wasn't found. It wasn't even suggested that that was important. The government was the appellant in this case. In that case, it wasn't arguing that Judge Smith was actually biased. The point was simply there was a violation of a bright line rule, and that triggers the point that I think was called out by Judge Toronto's questioning, which is it's difficult to understand the effect that a financial interest has on human decision making, and Congress meant to make that decision clear so that parties and judges and reviewing courts did not have to embark on what is a very difficult process to untangle psychological motivations. With respect to the Liljeburg factors, I mean, we rely primarily on Shell, which applied the Liljeburg factors, and we think this case is on all fours with Shell, but one can walk through them. I mean, in Liljeburg, in talking about the first factor, effect on the parties, the Supreme Court looked to see whether anyone had made a showing of special hardship by reliance on the individual judgment. Centripetal hasn't shown anything like that here. Certainly, vacator would delay a final judgment. That's true in every case, and I don't know of any authority that's relied on that under the first factor. Besides, Centripetal bears some of the blame for the delay. Had they not tried to waive an unwaivable conflict and instead said to the judge, you know what, there is a problem here, it might have been that a new judge could have come in very quickly and picked up where Judge Morgan had to leave off. Instead, we had full briefing on the post-judgment motions and briefing on this appeal, and so while that's unfortunate, it's not a special hardship to Centripetal. I think the second factor, the effect of a vacator on parties in other cases, the Supreme Court's own reasoning in Liljeburg applies just as well here. In fact, not vacating would send a very dangerous message to other cases that there are no practical consequences to a violation of 455B. Similarly, the third factor, public confidence in the judicial process, I think what this Court said and did in Shell applies just as well here. Finally, you cannot remand to the same judge. The Second Circuit in Chase Manhattan made very clear why you can't do that. That was a 455A case, all the more the case in a 455B context, simply selling the stock now and then reissuing a decision that was issued under the shadow of a longstanding 455B violation would not make any sense at all and would not be consistent with Congress's mandate.
And in your view, is the reassignment to be left to the chief judge of the Eastern District, if there is to be a reassignment?
I must confess, I don't know the answer to that. It would probably depend on the district's rules for reassignment, but that's probably the best way to do it. My understanding as well is that Judge Morgan has retired from the bench at this point, so I'm not even sure, you know, remanding to him is even a possibility.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted.